OK, so we have a free-ranging discussion, but the important first order of business is that I wanted all of us to thank Claudia and Daria and Craig and the AV folks, because I think that this has been a flawless coordination of activities. And so let's do that first. Yes, so thank you very much. And now, on to discussion. I don't know. There are a lot of big, I guess there are a lot of big lingering ideas, I guess. You know, I gave a two-minute talk on Monday about where I was hoping things would go, and I think we got to a lot of the places where I had hoped we would. I mean, everyone who came here already had a sense of the importance of boundary layers in their own fluid, maybe, but the connections to large-scale and long-time scale stuff like George describes. I mean, there are a lot of different pieces of this story. I think we've seen some aspects of both the underlying dynamics of the boundary layers, their consequences, how they're parametrized. So when I think about what would be, you know, what are the remaining pieces? What are the future directions? Are there things that people are confused, more confused by now than they were before this week? Or are there things that people are eager to do after this week? I guess that's sort of where I would be interested in starting a conversation, but if anybody else has anything else they'd like to say? It's a lot to digest. I know, that's too, this is a bad question. You know, this is like a, whatever, teaching 101. You don't ask open-ended questions like that because everybody gets too much, whatever. But nonetheless, here we go. Sure.
Beta, could you lead us through some of the themes in the week, and maybe that would unlock some more structured thoughts?
Sure. How do I put this up? I've forgotten. Nope. This one? Nope. This one? Nope. No, I can't lead us through the week. Oh, yeah, all right. Yeah, so I could draw the little picture that I drew before. So in the opening discussion, at our first week of the long program, I drew this little picture where I had, you know, I didn't have trees, but I'll add trees now for artistic purpose. And so we have different kinds of boundary layers in the Earth system, which is one part of the story, and we had different kind of boundary layers on the extraterrestrial systems. And so if you think about the kind of overarching pieces of this story, so if we have an energy budget to close, or we have a precipitation to predict, or we have a forecast problem, you know, in each of those, or if we have a atmospheric carbon excess problem, or we have a pollution on the surface problem, in the boundary layers always seem to play this role of mediating those exchanges. So it doesn't matter which one of the many boundary layers we're thinking about, they keep reappearing in these different contexts. And so from my perspective, the story in all of those regards is we need to get the exchanges, if the exchanges are driven externally, is there a reason why the boundary layer is resisting a transfer of carbon from the atmosphere to the ocean. Does the boundary layer set the rate, or is it really just the difference of the free atmosphere and the deeper ocean? Is it a, and so the role of the boundary layers, if they are doing an active job, is to do something special that can't be done by the rest of the system. So when we transfer, and we know all the sub-processes sit there, tweaking those little bits, and so we think about Langmuir turbulence, or we think about waves on the surface, and waves and the way that they transfer stresses across the surface, or, you know, like Andy's talk this morning, the bottom boundary layer having an influence on all of the currents above. So how do we, I guess in this version of this week, we haven't identified any boundary, we didn't talk about any boundary layers that I didn't know about before, so I think we know where they are, that they exist, but I think we definitely still have big questions about what they do, and I think the big questions about what they do is what they do in mechanism and precise form, but also when you connect the larger system onto them, what is their role in the overall energy budget? Carbon budget, momentum budget, freshwater budget of the systems they're attached to. I think there's still a lot of big questions about that. So if anybody would like to comment on something that, let's make it a little more precise. So someone who's in the atmosphere or someone, what did you learn from the ocean that you did not expect to see? Or someone who's in the ocean, what did you learn from the atmospheric talks? Or someone who's on the planetary side, what did you learn from the Earth side that we didn't expect to see? Or a piece of that? I think that's kind of an interesting starting point. I can give you an example. I was very surprised by Georgie's talk looking at the power spectra of the small-scale variability under ice in that it was a lot shallower than I expected it to be, even if it is a submesoscale instability, which Jim, as usual, when there's something that he hasn't seen in a model before, says is numerical problems. I'm not so sure it is numerical problems. I was surprised to think that there was some ice-ocean interaction that I was not expecting to see that represented. And so I look forward to finding out where you're going with that and what's more like that. Does someone else have another example of something like that was a piece outside of their primary focus that surprised them?
I mean, hello? So what I was surprised is how much atmospheric winds are correlated with ocean eddies on mesoscale. I think that was just the problem I never kind of considered in my life. And I think it's a perfect coupling problem between two boundary layers. So
we could do this in chain fashion. Frank, would you like to pick up the ball now that we're going ping-ponging around? Schaefer, can you hand Frank the mic?
Okay, well, this is something I really didn't, something I came here to work on and didn't get shown, but we didn't talk much about low latitude boundary layers. And particularly, what I came here to look at and to do some analysis on is what happens to Ekman layers as you get close to the equator. And I'm looking at something that looks very much like the kind of filaments that Jim showed. And in this case, the filament is the equatorial cold tongue. And we're seeing sort of agiotrophic, because it's on the equator, looks like secondary circulations that look just like those filaments, but at, of course, much, much larger scale. So that's something I want to pursue, that analogy, over the next couple of weeks along here. I guess since I said Jim, I have to.
You can pass the mic to Jim. I'm sure Jim has something to say. I will, but while in the interim, I will remind Jim that when we first did mixed layer instabilities, he told me those were noise too. So,
I was just going to refer to Frank's talk. I was surprised that the resolution of his atmosphere seemed to play very little role in the way that mesoscale eddies, the presence of mesoscale eddies that are affecting the fluxes. I was surprised by that, but maybe I'm just naive. So it seemed as though a 1 degree atmosphere, if you used a 1 degree atmosphere or a 1/4 degree atmosphere, you didn't change those fluxes very much. And yet the 1 degree atmosphere cannot be seeing the structure in the ocean.
It didn't have the SST anomalies to work with. I mean, the regression coefficients, given an SST anomaly, the regression coefficients were similar, but the fluxes weren't there because you didn't have the SST anomalies in the first place. Mm-hmm. So which is sort of suggesting that model is kind of working on 1D with 1D physics. So if you put an anomaly under it, it'll produce the flux. But, and I wasn't working over a very big range of atmospheric resolutions. It was a factor of 10 difference in the in the ocean, and factor of at most 4 in the atmosphere.
But atmospheric folks, would you say that 25 kilometers is mesoscale enough to do the job? I mean, or are there, I don't know, squall lines or something that are on a smaller scale that you would expect to see coming in if there had been more resolution?
Say it's good, because there you care about what's the natural scale of ocean mesoscale eddies, which is sort of 25 to 50 kilometers. Obviously, the atmosphere can be much better described with a finer resolution model than that in the tropics, the presence of deep convection. That could influence the ocean, too, and does through things like freshwater lenses and things like that.
I don't know. Craig's not here. There is a volume knob in there, but I'm terrified to mess with it. Is there a sense of how small these go? I mean, so some mesoscale eddies are 1 kilometer-ish in lots of parts of the world. Do we have a sense that there would still be a destabilization? I mean, when does it stop? When does the atmosphere no longer care about the fact that the SST is varying? We know that the surface of the ocean has a pretty shallow slope of SST variability all the way down to, you know, this scale. So when does it stop noticing?
Well, we have observations of cloud features, right? So
yeah.
Does that help us, Chris?
Well, if we look on coasts, right? I mean, coastlines are a good example if you have a stationary feature and not too much wind. The atmosphere can respond down to arbitrarily small scale. There's a blending height, there's a boundary layer, so you know, that kind of means that sub 1 kilometer scale can be less important.
Those are kind of different questions. There's a scale of motion, but you're asking at what point does the atmosphere stop caring about the boundaries, and isn't that what you were asking?
I was asking about whether there was a scale at which, I mean, the blending height is kind of where I was pointing, so
right, yeah.
There's a scale at which the atmosphere becomes non-hydrostatic and something quite different happens. There's a scale at which the ocean becomes non-hydrostatic and those slopes get quite different and you see a different kind of coupling, but this class of eddies destabilizing a whole boundary layer above them. How long do we go before that becomes the old hat in terms of resolution we're thinking about?
I don't know, but I think it's an excellent question.
To chime in, first, Chris's remark about, you know, permanent ocean and land boundaries is extremely apt. Anyone who spends time near a complicated shoreline knows all about sea breezes, land breezes, all sorts of headland effects, etc. A more generic answer comes from having done coupled Rahm's Wharf simulations and active submesoscale regimes. This is a body of work that Lionel Reynaud has led, and going down to resolutions of subkilometer, if you calculate the co-spectrum that is involved in wind work, which is the correlation of the wind stress with the ocean current, you see a continued correlation that is in the sense of energy coming out of the ocean into the atmosphere. And so there is definitely an energy exchange source that continues down to very small scales. Now, you know, its importance relative to other things, then, you know, it depends on how you want to pose that question. But the existence of the phenomenon is clear.
Do you want to talk about swell wind on that note? Stephen, since you told me we haven't talked about swell wind yet.
Perhaps I can comment on that and then broaden a little. So we looked at different ways that waves interact with the atmospheric boundary layer. And of course, there's a classical regime when a strong wind blows, and that drives energy into the waves, and the waves grow. But there was also a regime that actually, Peter, I think you sort of started us looking at, when the winds are very low, and you have swell running underneath that. And then it's possible to get a momentum transport from the waves into the wind. You can use reanalysis to say which regions of the world favor those two regimes. And the surprise is that about 50% of the globe favors the classical wind-generated wave. But then the subtropics and the tropics, where there's plenty of swell and relatively regions of low winds, this potential for a wave-driven wind regime is possible. And it actually, in weather models, when you have regions of high pressure between lows, with relatively weak winds, there are biases in the models there for overwind speed that this could be a contributor to. The difficulty with the regime is that you need to actually take some momentum out of the waves, otherwise you've got an unconstrained momentum source to the atmosphere, and weather forecast and climate guys don't like that, so I can't imagine why. So I think there is an interesting question about, and it's really coming to proper coupling. If we think wave processes are important, we need a full momentum and energy balance between the atmosphere, waves, and ocean that is fully consistent, I would say. I can pause on that. I wanted to raise the issue of boundary layers interacting with the larger scale flow. But
just before you start the new topic, just for clarification, Steve was remarking about the flux of energy from the ocean into the atmosphere due to the wave effect, and I was remarking due to eddy effects because I was talking about models that didn't have waves in them. And so they're both there as relatively small-scale energy transfers. Now, back to you.
Well, so I thought one of the things that Frank nicely brought out, and it came up maybe in Chris's talk and some of the others, is beginning to think about, many of us, myself included, are definitely boundary layer people. And I used to go to boundary layer conferences, and they were called boundary layer meteorology conferences, but there was no meteorology in them. It was just the boundary layer. So one of the things that I think we could be thinking more about is how these boundary layers are affecting the larger scale flow. And my perception is the oceanographic community have come from that perspective, but maybe the atmospheric community less so. There's an obvious motivation in the ocean on the biology side. So we saw a nice talk from Law, which showed export of stuff from the boundary layer into the deeper ocean. And then Chris, your cloud stuff. Clouds are obviously another way of mediating that, perhaps through radiation processes. But clearly clouds have a larger scale effect on the weather and climate as well. So I wonder, as a community, whether that's one of the things we should be thinking more about. And just to sharpen the problem, boundary layers have a coherence often because they're capped by a density inversion. So getting stuff from the boundary layer into the free troposphere or the deep ocean is a non-trivial thing to do. You know, models will diffuse it, right? But that's clearly not right. you've got to have some temporal variation or spatial variation. So temporally, you might re-stratify, so you cut off what was boundary area, becomes part of deep ocean. Or as you go from land-sea contrast, the atmospheric boundary layer goes, say, from deep over land to shallow in the ocean, so you can get the sort of blow-through effect there. But the 3D weather systems or mesoscale or sub-mesoscale processes is the other obvious way. So for me, it feels ripe to really confront that problem in a GFD way and then take that through to applications.
Who's got one? I can make a comment on that. There is a. So George's point of how we think about the climate variability and what are these really long time scales, you know, decadal, et cetera. One of the really challenging boundary layer aspects of that, if we think of it just from the perspective of global warming, which is a fast time scale along those longer time scales, is that the signal we have now, which is bigger probably than the paleoclimate signal, but it's not that big, is about a 1.5 watt per meter square anomaly arriving at the surface of the ocean. And this part down here versus this part up here, how much of that heat ends up there? This one is, for all intents and purposes, the reservoir of the fast timescale global system. So if this warms up, then the global mean surface temperature goes up. I don't think any of our boundary layer schemes, we would confidently say we know the rate of entrainment at that order of accuracy. So there are clearly some kind of large-scale feedbacks that are putting the peak decline just the way it needs to be. And if we're a little off, there must be some hidden negative feedback bringing it back, because we would not be able to do this problem at all if, in terms of the ocean heat content changes. We sort of do an okay job. We do know we can track the ocean heat content changes, the sea level rise, from models alongside what's going on, and at least in models informed by data like the echo reanalysis, that is a problem that you can think about, and you can know it does start to resemble the rate of trends. But we also know from the hiatus now over that the ocean can borrow this energy for a while in the subsurface and then burp it back up, and then we get big jumps at a big El Nino event like the 2015-2016 one. So if we really want to do that problem, to connect the longer than decadal signal through the decadal into the timescales we think of on boundary layers, that's the target for our accuracy, which is quite small.
But we do know the answer, even if we don't know the process. From ocean heat content changes, Argo measurements, most of that heat is penetrating well below the boundary layer.
Yeah.
But we also know that that happens in, a lot of that's happening in ocean deep convection regions. I mean, it's like in the atmosphere, how is stuff getting from the boundary layer to the deeper part of the fluid? Well, it's in isolated regions where the boundary breaks down. Boundary layer breaks down. I mean, in the atmosphere, there's a deep convection regions, and the moisture put into the atmosphere in boundary layer is coming out in the ITCZ, for instance, laterally, rather than.
But in measurements, a lot of it doesn't go in just in the deep convection.
Yeah.
It's more widespread than that.
The GFDL folks, Steve Griffey is leading, did a beautiful paper where they flipped on and off switches in the coupled system and asked how much it would have affected the variables that lead to sea level rise, and found that a lot of the boundary layer stuff played an outsized role in that particular, because whether or not you get sea level rise at a point has an awful lot to do with how much heat you're able to detrain out of the boundary layer. And the submesoscale processes were important. The mesoscale processes were important. The boundary layer mixing was important in getting that right.
So open
plus deep convection.
So you're saying that open ocean and coastal process,
processes were more important than, say, coastal and bottom boundary level?
No, just that it's a combined effect. At least in the model world, they are coming together with a rather surprising kind of set of circumstances. And open ocean was not negligibly small.
I raised my hand a time ago when the discussion were more general, so I'm stepping back. And I would like to say something for young people to show a bit of optimism in the situation where we are. Because we are rising problems, so it seems to be. But when I start, the first thing I was said by a professor at MIT at the time was that oceanographer considers the atmosphere as a place where the wind blows. And the meteorologist considers the ocean as a wet surface. And that was the end of the story. So we have already gone a long way ahead, of course. And I mean, that's what where we are, so to judge. One of my enlightening moments was the picture that someone showed the other day of the Earth taken from the moon. And when I do some lecture about meteorology, I always point out that if we take the Earth like a 2 meter diameter, you ask two people what's the thickness of the ocean and what's the thickness of the atmosphere. And that is about 4 millimeter and 10 millimeter. So in my point of view, since the start, since I've seen that picture, that photo, it was obvious that these two layers could not be considered separately. I mean, it was absolutely. And the question in general that we should, before starting digging in one problem because we love the problem, is that which is a target, which is a resolution, and the accuracy, what you mentioned now, that we need to reach that target. We can do research for the benefit of research, but if we have a target, we must frame the problem in general and decide which accuracy we need and where to reach that target.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I want to comment both on this ocean atmosphere interaction. But first, I want to get back to the point that Baylor just made. There's this really tiny flux into the ocean surface, and we're much concerned about it where we have models. To me, by far, the best test for these models are the Milankovitch cycles. People, for example, in that video I showed at Harvard, many people think that the Earth is closer to the sun in summer than winter, and this is usually dismissed as the wrong answer to the question why there's seasons. It's actually part of the answer. The seasons have two reasons. The one is the precession, which takes us closer and further from the sun. The other is obliquity. And they're usually thought of as extremely long timescales, 40,000 years or 20. Both actually also involve the seasons. So we have a lot of information about past seasons by looking at these Milankovitch cycles. And I feel they, by far the best test we have for our models, that nature is performing these experiments. We know precisely how the sunlight is changing in time and space. We can do it not by necessarily running 40,000 year cycles, but instead by studying the seasonal cycle at different times in the past. So there's a, think of it as sort of an orchard nobody has entered, but the way people have been looking at the response to Milankovitch cycles has completely ignored very fascinating facets of that. And I'm sort of encouraged by this meeting, and it's been a fascinating meeting bringing different phenomenology to my attention. I learned something interesting every day. So I'm hoping there can be a pursuit of, it has to be a group effort to explore how the Milankovitch forcing, how our models do in reproducing that. The other one comment I want to get back to the need to look at ocean atmosphere interaction. And to me, the most amazing moment at this meeting was when Zhao gave a talk, and he assumed that he said, why does the ocean play such a small role in determining sea surface temperature? There was a bit of a discussion, and it occurred to me that meteorologists, oceanographers, look at the world in entirely different ways, and that actually is relatively little communication between the two groups. I've started a discussion with Tapio, and I have to continue it. Tapio's convinced the ocean as a model that can reproduce much without taking the ocean into account. And I have to persuade him otherwise, that the very question he's addressing can be looked at from a different perspective. I'm not sure. I wanted to get back to how do we, the ocean atmosphere interaction. I wanted to get back to the issue of communicating science. I'm not sure that it's a completely different topic in some sense. Let me just give motivation for why I am so obsessed with getting the public interested in science. And it's simply a mode of, it's an attempt to recover my youth. So I'm an old man, and I started my career, and what impressed me most was a story I heard. It's a story about a pig and a hen. And I heard the story at a meeting at MIT in 1974. And what happened, the purpose of that meeting, the meteorologists are extremely well-organized people, and they wanted an experiment on convection in the tropics. And they had, they're powerful, and they'd arranged for something like 30, 40 ships to assemble in the tropical Atlantic Ocean. And they've decided where these ships would be located and what these ships should measure. And at this stage, they approached oceanographers and says, is there anything useful you can do with 40 ships sitting in the Atlantic Ocean? And so this meeting was called, and there were several oceanographers present. And one of them wanted to argue that there is no point in oceanographers participating in this particular project. And he told the following story, that a pig and a hen went for a walk on one very pleasant summer's day. And the sun was shining brightly, but there was a pleasant breeze and so on. And they enjoyed themselves thoroughly. And they enjoyed themselves so much that nightfall caught them by surprise. And so all of a sudden they were in the dark, but they noticed some lights in the distance. And they walked towards the lights. And when they got close by, it turned out to be an inn, and they could read the sign for the inn. And the sign said, bed and breakfast, bacon and eggs. And the hen was absolutely enthusiastic. They had to spend the night there. And the pig was quite reluctant. And so the pig explained to the hen that for her, this would amount to a fairly minor contribution. She had to lay a few eggs. To him, it was a major commitment. And so this oceanographer, I think it was John Swallow was his name, he explained that oceanographers are committed to their field. Whereas meteorologists are hens. They're very gregarious, they're outgoing, they use other people's data. Oceanographers, on the other hand, go into the unknown, they endure terrible conditions to get their data, they treasure it, they put it into atlases. Now, you have to understand the context for the story, that at that time there was a debate about, amongst oceanographers, as to whether there is variability in the ocean. So this may sound astonishing, but you would go out on the ship, you'd collect data, you'd put in an atlas. This was also a time when people questioned whether or not computers are useful tools. Okay, so it's a striking difference between meteorologists. The moment a computer was invented, meteorologists jumped on it. Von Neumann organized a group, and they were going to use this to predict the weather. Oceanographers, on the other hand, very suspicious of this thing, that they had grown up learning about all sorts of mathematical techniques, and they were determined to pursue those. And the upshot of this meeting was the oceanographers went off and had their own project. They were interested in eddies. And they thought the neighborhood of the Gulf Stream. I was a youngster, and people such as myself, Dennis Moore, Mark Cain, we certainly did not go on ships. And we were pulled into this program. We were assured by our colleagues that there's nothing interesting in the tropics, that there is some crazy German in Hawaii who carries on about El Nino. forget about it. There's not. So the whole environment was entirely different. But I do believe that oceanographers tend to be pigs and that meteorologists tend to be hens. And it's sort of interesting that on Tuesday it became apparent that there still is a difference between pigs and hens, and that we still need to bridge that. We in this room all week, we live in a bubble. Right? The outside world does not intrude. Nonetheless, it does affect us. And so you can ask, what's the big difference? So the other thing I wanted to point out, that when you went on a ship in the 60s, 70s, into the 80s, you didn't know where you were unless you had a sextant and there were stars. And so it was a busy romantic activity. There's a poem by Masefield, I must down to the seas, again, to the lonely seas. Anyway, I need a ship and a star. And many oceanographers can quote this poem of Masefield. The GPS is a very recent thing. So the world has changed enormously. There's no point in trying to recover that. But we now have things such as cell phones. Even every African has it. And I think that we need a project. We also need a bottom-up. We've become really top-down. So even our bubble has been affected by the end of the Cold War, whether we like it or not. Our funding has. We shouldn't merely accept what's the current state of affairs, which is most unfortunate. So I feel we need to step outside our bubble and get involved with the public. We have to persuade people that there is a room for pigs, that we need people who make commitments and who don't simply take advantage of existing. So I feel there's a complement is needed to the top-down mode in which we conduct science now. We have huge international organizations. They form committees, and this committee cannot have everybody from Princeton, must at least have one body, Scripps, and so on. There are all sorts of arbitrary rules. Is it possible to have a bottom-up movement where you behave like a pig, you make a commitment, and to do it for the purpose of getting the public interested in science? And so I didn't expect an answer here, but I'll send out an email and try to get your support. What I would like is for us to celebrate next year, 2019, the 50th anniversary of the first picture of planet Earth from the moon. To those who were around at the time, it was a moving experience to see our fragile planet. And can we celebrate that occasion? And so I want to propose we approach a local museum, and I'm speaking to people here, every town seems to have one, and have them do something between equinox. Suppose we start 21st of September, continue until another equinox, until we would have passed the solstice, and make people at least aware of what is an equinox, what is a solstice, what's the significance. It cannot be done just in one place. It will gain enormously if it were in two places. So your museum should become a sister museum to some other place where the seasonal cycle is very different, simply to make people aware of this diversity. But the whole goal should be to make them aware of how amazing this planet is. And so if you have any, the first step really would be to organize ourselves. And there I'm already stuck. It was easy after that meeting at MIT, 1974, funds were readily available, all sorts of small groups formed too. And they brought together, as I said, people who never go to sea, people who are addicted to writing down equations, people who even use computers. All those people came together. To me, it was actually the most exciting period in my life, that I belonged to a community that pursued a similar goal. And so if you have any ideas to how to go about this, I notice people on Facebook seem to have hundreds of friends. Anyway, I'm looking for ideas. If anybody has any suggestions as to how to proceed, the first step is to organize ourselves, not top down, not to ask the IPCC to form yet another committee, but a group of people who are actually interested in this. How do we continue from there? It should be on a small scale. I've approached the museum in Trenton and in Cape Town. I'm not sure what will work, what don't, but we need to try a few more such experiments, see what does work. And hopefully we can go, I don't even know what the word means, but hopefully we can go viral. Thank you.
Well, one of the things we were talking about at the break was that in addition to the idea about the equinox is I mentioned NASA's cloud app that people can download online and onto their cell phones to take photos to contribute data information about clouds, where you know it's so it because it's a cell phone, it detects your longitude and latitude and altitude, and so when you take a photo of a cloud, you can, you know, basically send that information to NASA and participate in taking data about clouds. And it might be sort of an interesting idea to create something like that, where people can take photos of other types of things, regional plants and whatnot, but the goal being to sort of chart the seasonal cycle, because George was talking about the importance of the seasonal cycle and the fact that one of the primary manifestations that of climate change that that people generally can observe are changes in their local seasonal cycles. So, it might be a sort of an interesting project for a lot of people. If they like going on hikes or nature walks, they can just take their cell phone with them and take photographs of the plant life in a certain area, and then over a year, or a few years, they then have information about the time that certain plants die off and other plants bloom and that sort of thing. And if a lot of people did that everywhere, there could be a lot of information about the seasonal cycle, and people could feel like they're participating in that. And there could also be a link to climate change so that they could see how climate change is affecting them in their local area. So that was just one thing that we talked about at the break. I wanted to mention the Globe Network online. It might be one mechanism to use to organize something like this and connect communities from different hemispheres.
I have a bit narrower thoughts, and I don't know if that's the right time. They relate to the discussion, but they're a good bit narrower. I don't know if others want to talk about the seasonal cycle and like first. Maybe others should speak up first. Otherwise, okay. Let me just say what I thought. Sitting in the talks here and in the beginning of discussion.
Hold it a little closer to your mouth.
I can. I think it's. That many oceanographers spoke up, it's probably just in part the fact that there are more oceanographers here than atmospheric scientists. But I think there's also another part why that is the case, because the ocean is dry and you don't have to contend with the complexities of latent heat release. And right now I'm teaching a boundary layer and cloud dynamics class, and I was missing teaching this week. It is a very difficult class to teach, and I think it came through in this meeting as well. There's a certain disconnect between where we have theories, what we can explain, what is interesting to students, And what actually happens, say, in a climate model, the students in the class all want to know what's going on in the climate model, of course. They'll be users of climate models, maybe some will help develop them. But that's what they're interested in, climate question. And if you just look at textbooks on boundary layer dynamics, climate doesn't enter. Even the question of how, you know, nice little theories we have for diffusive growth of a convective boundary layer, how that relates to what actually is coded up in a parameterization is not addressed in standard textbooks. And clouds doesn't even enter for the most part. There is, and we have very few theories there, right? I mean, we have sort of the stratocumulus top mixed layer model. That's about all we have in terms of models that we use to explain how clouds work. Cumulus clouds is very little. And I think it's a problem for the field, and this gets back to, in a much smaller scale, what George was saying, how to get people interested in it. I think what we're lacking is a systematic development that goes from, you know, from coarse to finer, from equations of motion and phenomena to what actually in the end goes into a model, which it is very, very difficult to figure that out from the published literature, often impossible. And I think that's unhealthy for the field that there is this disconnect. And the way to bridge the disconnect is not so much to just teach about all the kludges that are in models, but not have the kludges in the models and have a more systematic development that goes from theory to things you actually use. And I think that's what's missing, and also was missing at the meeting to a degree, because it's just not there in the field. And if you had it, it would be much easier to teach classes. It would be much more interesting for students to get involved, right? It's striking how few people are here and how little attention this field receives, given how important everyone acknowledges it is, right? So there's an enormous disconnect between the claimed societal value of figuring out what clouds will do and the actual amount of funding going into making models for clouds better. And I think in part it's because it's a mess to explain what's going on in models right now. And I think we need to do better there.
I would say a topic
because there actually it seems to me, and I haven't looked at ocean models so much, but it seemed to me that the talks people gave, it's just this was, you know, logical, nice physical development, and if models actually look like these talks, that would seem a lot better than what I know about the atmospheric boundary layer and convection.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a really poignant point that actually sort of brings together both the earlier discussion about models and coupling models and what George has been saying about connecting with the general public. When I was in graduate school, I also did a degree in environmental policy, and one of the things that came up repeatedly was this issue of error in scientific results and whether or not. Well, I'll just use a specific example. In 1989, Stephen Schneider was interviewed by, I think it was Discover Magazine, and he basically said that he felt that scientists had a moral responsibility to downplay uncertainties in order to convince the public that, you know, that climate change was real in order to have them convince politicians to pass mitigating legislation. And I had made the argument in those classes, which were, you know, a lot of my peers in those classes were people who were studying sociology or journalism or political science or law, and their intent was to, after they got their degree, go out and, you know, be activists, basically. And I made the mistake, quote unquote, of making the argument that this was ultimately more damaging to the environmental movement, because if specific predictions didn't happen exactly the way we said, without, you know, and no type of uncertainty was discussed, then that would sort of backfire, and people, the scientific community would lose credibility. And, you know, sort of a lot of this political machine that has been out there trying to prevent, you know, funded by the fossil fuel industry, that's been out there trying to prevent greenhouse gas mitigation legislation, has basically taken advantage of the fact that we don't talk about errors and uncertainties when we talk about science to the public. But editors at magazines and newspapers are pretty much convinced that if you don't create a dramatic story, or if you, as soon as you start talking about uncertainties, it confuses people and people sort of tune out. So there's this big disconnect, and I think it's probably the scientific community's responsibility, unfortunately, to do something about it, because we're the ones who understand uncertainty and what the uncertainties in our work do or don't actually mean. And so this sort of raises the question, how do we communicate uncertainty to the public? How do we prevent the communication of that uncertainty from, how do we make sure that communicating that uncertainty creates more good than bad in terms of funding for science and important results being understood by the general public so that important legislation can be passed that's related to those scientific results? And how do we make uncertainty interesting to the general public? Because we have to figure out how to make it interesting and feel relevant and also be comprehensible to lay people who don't really understand a lot of mathematics, in order for that uncertainty to be communicated. So I think that that's both related to climate models and the current state of development, as well as what George has been talking about. I don't know if people have thoughts about that or not.
So I'm just going to make a plug for, so Mike Mann and I just published an article, it's actually in Science News, which is a Society of Industrial and Applied Mathematics, and it's essentially in response to the Pruitt's administration claim that, you know, there's too many uncertainties to be doing responsible climate. At the same time, they claim that, you know, climate is always changing, so that itself is an obvious contradiction of things. But so the point with the article was to show that using very elementary techniques, you can actually include uncertainties very naturally and make assessments. And so it's meant to be, the point is not to use anything sophisticated, but to say, yes, we know how to include these uncertainties. And in fact, this is part of what we do. So that was the point of the article. So if you want it.
I guess I want to get back to Tapio's point, which I think I felt many of the same issues in trying to, for instance, teach a course on boundary layers, or I teach about clouds, or I have people working on ocean boundary layers in my class, and, you know, realizing it's quite complex, especially by the time you're talking about the interaction of various boundary layers with all kinds of different physics. But one tool that I think we underutilize the coolness factor of is the fact that a lot of us do use large eddy simulation or some equivalent, and you can make these really cool movies with it. I mean, things like Perpetual Ocean, for instance. I mean, I don't think it takes being a scientist to see, you know, a series of eddies spinning off in the Agulhas Current as being cool. I mean, it's just amazing that this stuff is going on and that we have models that can simulate all of this sort of multi-scale detail. And, you know, one thing I don't think we've sort of organized ourselves as a field to do is to make full use of those techniques educationally. It's actually relatively hard to get a hold of really good animations, for instance, phenomena that we know that we've simulated, because we don't kind of pass them around to each other. We don't have an awful lot of organized funding right now for turning those into something more educational. But I think in terms of coolness factor, it's something we could be definitely doing more with.
Yeah, and YouTube is an amazing resource. It's very easy to take your research video, put a voiceover on it, and put it on YouTube. I mean, it takes half an hour after you know what you're doing. I mean, learning it the first time is hard. Putting up multiple videos is not a whole lot harder than putting up one.
I agree. I just wanted to respond to Dara's point. Dara or Dara? You know, so I'm going to turn 50 this year, so I graduated undergraduate, you know, around 86. And, I mean, high school and undergraduate 90. So, you know, I'm basically not a kid that age. So it's been a full generation, and I've heard exactly the same thing that you said at the beginning then, you know, and everybody was aware that scientists couldn't communicate uncertainty and that climate change was happening, but people were a little too dumb, the populace, to really understand the complex science and pull it through. And so here we are a generation later, and, you know, you're still bringing this up and saying we need to figure out what to do as scientists. So I have one idea, which is I think I'd like to stick to the idea that, in fact, the physics is not that complicated, and to try to work out a way to tell small stories that take a little attention span, that maybe involve, you know, using cool videos, but that really try to explain, I mean, the physics of even the 1D, 0D warming model for, you know, how you get a higher surface temperature, why you get seasons. I mean, all of these things, simple stories that aren't too simple, but maybe naturally bring in uncertainty or something, but, you know, we can't just keep asking. I mean, I don't know, are there any other ideas? What are we supposed to do?
Well, as an incoming grad student or middle career grad student, I find that one of the hardest things in getting into this field is the jargon that people use, and people forget what it's like to be new and what it's like not to know all the terms. And if you're talking about simple ideas, I think that that's the biggest thing that one could do to make the field be inviting and have people that are not exactly from the specific field know the different terms and want to collaborate on it and want in, because it is really interesting. But if you don't know what EBF means, you know, how do you even know what you're talking about? So I think for me, that's one of the biggest things is you can't even start talking about it until you really know the terms.
And I think actually going back to George's point, even equinox is a word that people do not know what that means. I mean, that's almost the same thing as not knowing what causes the seasonal cycle. I mean, this is not for incoming grad students necessarily, but what we talk in a language that is not the language of everyone else who's listening. And to say that, you know, clouds provide shade, that's something that people can grab onto. High clouds might provide a different kind of shade than low clouds. That's still something people can hold on to. The ocean is warmer than the air sometimes and colder than the air other times. We don't come back to those bedrock pieces of what we're talking about because the research frontier is far away, but those stories are great.
You can even mention the hiatus once you just get the basic idea that
exactly.
The scale of the ocean is, you know, an order of magnitude longer. It's not hard to understand that there's a bit of a flywheel effect and you can get a decade old.
So I come from the field of condensed matter physics before I started working on climate-related problems 10 years ago or so. And condensed matter physics, which is actually the largest area of physics represented in physics departments, suffers from many of the same problems as climate science. So Wolfgang Pauli referred to solid-state physics, the earlier name for condensed matter physics, as dirt physics. To distinguish it from, you know, pure particle physics or gravitational wave physics, all these things that get the attention. I was talking to Tapio about this last night, these kind of exotic areas that have some sort of kind of quasi-religious, evoke some sort of religious feelings, I think, among many people. And so this field of condensed matter physics, like climate physics, has struggled with trying to get the message across about how wonderful, you know, there's a huge diversity of phenomena, just like in climate physics, many sorts of forms of emergent properties and so on. And many things have been tried and not too many things have been successful. But one thing that I think has been successful recently is there's a new online publication called Quanta Magazine. How many of you have heard of Quanta Magazine? It's supported by the Simons Foundation, and it has some terrific writers who understand the science and are very good at kind of getting at the, what's exciting about the field. Now, maybe half of the articles at least are on all the exotic black holes and string theory and all that. But there are a number that are on a more seemingly mundane areas. And I've been trying to cultivate their interest in climate science, and had a very long conversation with Natalie Woltrover, who's one of their main writers. I think she talked to Tapio also. And so I'd encourage you to maybe reach out to them if you have some, some groundbreaking work. That's a way at least of reaching sort of the informed public to convey the excitement of our field that George was talking about.
I'll add something. It seems like a lot of these points relate to like pedagogy and outreach. I noticed yesterday that we didn't have time for the like forum discussion on diversity and retention and stuff in this community. And I think that during the talks, though, we talked a lot about like this leaky pipeline thing. You know, there are a lot of different points, and that exists. But this is kind of a point in that pipeline. And like an Earth system model, if we just like focus on the whole thing, that wouldn't be a really effective way to improve climate science. You know, it's better to maybe focus on something. And so one of the most effective ways we can improve diversity, but also I think improve pedagogy, is to focus on what's going on in this community here in this room. And understanding the subtleties that contribute to not having, you know, a diversity in this room might improve our teaching techniques as well. So I think that it would be helpful to just have more discussion about that here in this room.
For example,
what would you recommend?
We should have a discussion.
You would recommend a discussion.
Like, hey, like,
okay,
what
yeah.
do you think is going on? Like breaking small groups, like that's like, you know, our obligation to do. But the same. Like, yeah, I mean, if I was gonna do it, I'd count off everyone going to randomized small groups and have facilitators in each of those groups mm-hmm. and talk about, you know, what we think is going on. Mm-hmm. But that's because you asked what I should do.
Yeah.
What would you do?
I think, well, one piece of what I would do and what I have been fortunate to be associated with Empower, I went to the Petullo conference and now I'm on the board. One of the things that they do or try to do is to bring social science evidence about what actually works in retention, as opposed to spouting off about retention, which is, you know, scientists love to spout off about things. Especially, you know, hypothesis building is just a wonderful, exciting activity. My wife always tells me that that's just pure speculation. And then at one point I was laughing with another friend of mine who's a theoretical physicist that was really my job, was speculation. So why isn't that why isn't that great? But it's not great when it really matters. And having a back and forth about our own personal experiences is an important part of that. But also having a perspective that says, you know, what are the structures that are really in the way of things working the way we think they work? I mean, I think, so my wife is a social worker, and so one of the differences between social work and psychology, one of the most important differences is that social work tries to address the structures in society that prevent people from doing whatever, from being what they could be. what we frequently don't do when we have conversations is we think it's a, if only I had a better conversation with my students, they wouldn't have dropped out. Not, what is my university, what are the policies at my university, like my favorite at the moment, legacy admissions, that are making it so that we can't change the problems we have. We're looking them right in the face, but some of them are so ingrained in our perception of the they're not even part of the problem because they're ingrained in our understanding of how the systems and structures exist. So, I don't know. I mean, I think that's part of the, and that's a hard nut to crack. That takes, you know, it's hard because it's like science. Social scientists have the same. It is hard to see the underlying dynamics. It's hard to recognize those pieces, especially if you don't have a diversity of case studies. Pretty much all universities in the world run kind of the same way. So how do we just, how do we see what's wrong with all of them together?
To sort of tell a story as an observer, in our atmosphere and ocean department at UCLA, we've gone through a process of largely having renewed the faculty. The majority of our faculty members are now young. And with them has come a fresh breeze, from their perspective, that there's a great deal of evidence-based social assessment-based evaluation of teaching techniques, particularly large undergraduate lecture courses, the general threat of which is that large undergraduate lecture courses as lecture courses don't work. And so there are a whole bunch of techniques, you know, clickers and you know, 5-minute sudden exams and all sorts of other things. I only teach graduate courses, so for me it's a spectator sport, but there's considerable conviction that an enormous difference can be made in the effectiveness of undergraduate education. There's a pipeline question in you know, science majors as well, that a lot of people intending to become science majors don't stay the full 4 years. And you know, these things apparently work. And what we're now talking about is how that turns into a discourse between you know, the scientists and the broader culture. I don't know of any evidence-based information there. But that's what we're talking about, I guess.
Well, so at the University of Washington, we have something called the Program on Climate Change, whose job it is to act as glue between the various geophysical science departments, atmospheric science, oceanography, earth system, or earth sciences, and biology in particular. And one of the most successful things that we've had actually is something called the Graduate Climate Conference, which is basically a kick the old fogies out type thing where you have to be a graduate student or a postdoc to present. All of the sessions are run by graduate students and so on. And you know, I think people like Jim or Tapio or me or everyone, Baylor or everyone else in this room who talk is an old, well, no, not necessarily. We're even old fogies, but we get to talk a lot. And I think the most important form of diversity would be getting other people to talk more. And so in particular, something like that at KITP could be a good thing, no old fogies conference. And that might by itself encourage a certain kind of diversity of thought that we don't have right now.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things about planning this meeting over the long part has been how different those assumptions are for the physics community versus the geophysics community, which is not that far apart. The degree to which students are invited here is actually extremely restricted. There are very few desks for graduate students. They are hotly competed for by our group and sort of ignored by some of the other programs because that's not the emphasis of what KITP is about. So, and why that is historical, cultural, all kinds of things. But I mean, it's been interesting to see the differences of how the rules are set up here versus how this would have been done if we did it at Scripps, say.
To that point, Baylor, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, but what's your name? Abby. Yeah, to Abby's point as well. Something we could do at this meeting, which would be very straightforward, and I was just talking to Brad about how it would work out technically. So we all our talks have been posted, and we could put a one paragraph plain language summary of our talks. I think we could all handle that little bit of homework, right? And then we could ask maybe the organizers, I could help with this, but to write a couple of paragraphs in plain language about this particular workshop and why the problems we're studying are important, and maybe a little bit about what we learned. And at least there's a record. And I think people look back at the talks that are posted here on the KITP website, and they last forever. I mean, you can go back and see some very embarrassing moments if you want, and no names. But you can actually, they go back to the inception of the program. So just a suggestion, but it would be one that is actually actionable right now. And so, you know, for those of you who are willing to write, you know, a few sentences about your talk, we'll talk to Lars about how to get that information up.
A bigger form of that would be a glossary.
No, I'm saying a plain language. Hopefully we can come up with the words without needing an additional glossary. But,
AANS actually has a great online glossary. This is one thing I link to in lots of classwork. So most of the AMS. Yeah.
We could use technical terms, but we'd have to explain them, right? And then, you know, if you want to learn more, then this is where you go. So. That's a concrete suggestion in terms of one small part of the discussion.
It's a good suggestion. My joke was a joke, but it wasn't about your suggestion. It was about my thoughts.
The only reason I suggested it is because actually, gentlemen, I think what was discussed here this week was extremely important. Really.
Just to conclude on an optimistic note again, 2007 I went back to South Africa, and my assignment was to attract more students to science. South Africa faces a big problem that the people who emigrated at the end of apartheid were all young, highly educated. And so there's actually no replacements in sight for people about to retire. And so I started to Habitat Planet workshop, and it goes on for 10 days. And the idea was to introduce students to earth science and to persuade them to continue with graduate study. So this was intended for undergraduates. And to my amazement, it works like a charm. And we've asked students to assess the workshop, and I'll send you copies of two letters in particular that are representative. But the reason that it worked had little to do, there were some simple principles. A, keep authority figures out of the picture. And so the whole thing was psychology. It worked because it increased their self-confidence. So the whole point of apartheid really was to undermine self-confidence of black people. This case worked by simply telling them that where they live is amazing. And so Cape Town is this astonishing place that I mentioned yesterday, but most people at Cape Town live in slums, and they've never been to the top of that mountain you saw there. There are amazing botanical gardens, aquaria. They've never been to any of these. And so the workshops in the morning would have lectures by people who had been trained. It was mostly graduate students. Then in the afternoon, they went on field trips. And just being able to climb the mountain, they'd seen this mountain from. It was an astonishing experience for many of these people. And the snag is, at the moment, the government supports 6 of these workshops a year, each attended by 30 students. That's a drop in the bucket. We need to scale this up. And that's the challenge. The only plus thing is every African has a cell phone, and they seem to look at it all the time. The no different from Americans. The can we somehow scale this up? And that was the reason for my proposal earlier this morning, that they're very curious about other places. And once they've convinced them that where they live is the most amazing place, they should be proud of it, they will be very pleased to explain to people elsewhere what this is like. Can we set up such a scheme? And I'm glad to, somebody here from Los Alamos, somebody locally, I think has left the room now, but I discovered there are quite a few people who are already doing this. So the whole goal would be challenge locals, to take an interest in what they have by having them explain to others by means of videotapes or whatever. Somehow, I've heard this word viral, but if we can try this in a few places next year, can we do it in such a way that many other people can copy it? But the whole goal would be to capitalize on these videos that Chris mentioned. NASA makes available, but not in a suitable format. I mean, we have to persuade NASA to somehow put together videos that will appeal to people. We can go on and we get into details at this point. But I'll get Darius' support and send emails around. Send you a website of this Habitable Planet workshop group in Cape Town. And you can have a look at that and see whether we can copy something like that.
All right, so to end on a truly optimistic note, echoing George, thank you all for coming for this week. Your work truly is amazing. I hope to see you all soon. Thanks.